to me, it's actually very deeply ironically sad that when the Balchuva, who has so many interesting, artistic, important insights to bring from their past that are actually valuable, feel intimidated once they become religious and feel that somehow these things have to be totally discarded. This to me is a tragedy. Instead of thinking of a life as an attempt to synthesize these elements, which albeit is a very difficult thing to do, is a constantly difficult thing to do, but to be real with one's religion, you have to be real with yourself, and to be real with yourself means not severing these things. And if one wants to look at a really interesting Torah source on this, we don't have time for this, one should look at the later chapters of Rabbi Soloveitchik's book on repentance, in which he talks about the necessity of integrating all the parts of the self. Since that time, I have learned in various forums, and I guess in that respect, one more Hakara Tov is to my first and longest and ongoing chavruta, which is with Rabbi Yaakov Kirzner. Yanki and I began learning when I came back from yeshiva and learned for many years together, actually, on a consistent basis. And there was an interesting example to me of an interface between somebody who had been brought up Orthodox and myself, and it was an example of what I think can be brought to the table. For he brought some of his religious training, and I brought some of my university training, and we would learn a bit and scream for the rest of the time. And it was very fruitful, because I think for both of our lives, and he can speak for himself, it created a tremendous synthesis, a way of seeing the other side of the line and be able to integrate those elements, and I think we were both the richer for it. And I don't think it's a small matter when you are religious, whether you're a Balchuva or a from birth person, to be able to find somebody to explore texts with, to learn with, a special partner. And of course, the most special partner in my life, my soulmate, my wife Leah, was also an integral part of that process, because she grew up from birth, but is a person who I think in the finest sense of the word is a Bala Tshuva every day, because she has an unceasing quest for looking at how things work, and probably the most acute insights into human beings that I have met in my lifetime. So that's Bekitsur, where I am, and it's a little bit ironic. I'm sitting in a room. I haven't spoken in this synagogue in 4 years. I worked at the synagogue for many years, running a beginner's minyan, a learner's minyan, whatever you want to call it, and left it in 2001. So I guess that's also a little bit full circle for me. What I wanted to take the discussion into and open it up now was to talk a little bit about the business of integration, which I alluded to before, and also the idea of how Balei Tshuva feel once they enter the from birth community, because that's not a simple matter, and I think it's not something you're really prepared for when you enter it, especially when it comes to the issue of having parts of yourself that you feel are really valuable, are really good. Let's say you're somebody in the arts who has been a musician, a dancer, an actor, a writer, and how to bring those parts into religion is to me a central issue. And I think I wanted to throw this over to Dr. Aiken, and maybe you can, especially because you've thought about this both from a religious perspective, also a clinical perspective, I know, where you've treated people, and this has come up, I'm sure, quite often.
Well, to be perfectly frank, I never could understand why Balei Tshuva wanted to be part of the mainstream from community. I never wanted to be part of it, and when people would tell me that they were trying to be accepted by that community, I was always startled, because to me, we had so much more life and vitality in us than they did. I mean, we chose to be religious. They were stuck with it. And so time and time again, when I would come into circles with people who were always religious, their religion seemed so dead to me and so lifeless. And their way of life just seemed so monolithic that I couldn't imagine wanting to be part of that community. I mean, there was almost nothing in my world that I felt wasn't better than what was in their world. They were boring. They couldn't relate to anything I had to say. Their way of life seemed so rigid. If I would ask them about God, they'd look at me like I was psychotic. And so as a product of becoming religious primarily in the 70s, it was a time that to me was so exciting where I was coming from and so taken for granted where they were coming from that I was not really part of that world. I found that over the years, when more and more Balei Tshuva were becoming part of that mainstream, that what I was seeing in my practice were people who were becoming clinically depressed and very disturbed, because in order to become part of that world, they had to cut off so many parts of themselves. In many ways, not ever wanting to be part of the other side, so to speak, I couldn't totally relate to their desire to be accepted. And yet, I felt that as a therapist, there were aspects of what they were trying to do that were just so unhealthy that regardless of whether they became accepted or not accepted, they had to refine themselves. And so one of the issues that I've dealt with many people in my practice has been exactly the issue of integration versus giving up yourself. And I think that for many Balei Tshuva, there's no distinction, that they don't think about retaining their individuality as a necessary component of becoming integrated into the, what I'll call the FFB community, or even the mainstream Balei Tshuva community today, which is no longer what it was back in the 1970s. One of the things I discussed with Elliot over Shabbat was that the people that I saw who had the most difficulty with this were the most creative people, and very often those were artists. They were people who were in the performing arts, they were artists, they were in some cases writers, but whatever they were doing was something that was considered treif in the frum world. And on top of it, very often their talents were very much trivialized. Well, you know, before you became religious, so you wanted to be a dancer, but now get real with your life. Or, you know, I know you were an artist before, but you can always do ketuvas. I actually know a number of women who became frum who used to dance with the Joffrey Ballet in New York, and they were told, well, you can always dance at chasanas. And there is absolutely no understanding from the FFB world that it's not the same. And when people would give up their passion, I felt they gave a part of themselves. And part of what I try to encourage people to do who are becoming Baal Tshuva is to realize that there may be parts of you that the FFB world will never accept. And you have to come to terms with it either by finding a place to direct your passions or by coming to terms with the fact that you will be different. My sister, who's a farmer in Baltimore, is a little bit different. And my sister and I had a conversation many years ago, and she said, you know, my sister's also very, very creative. And she said to me, I had a choice with my children to either decide to help them become like everybody else or to help them become comfortable with being different. And one of the messages that I think I often give to people is the idea that being different is not being bad. That part of being Jewish 2,000 years ago was the acceptance of many different flavors of Judaism that were all authentic. And today I'm afraid that many of us are being pushed to feel that only one flavor is the one flavor to be. And so I try to encourage people to become comfortable saying, you know something? Being different doesn't mean I'm not religious. It doesn't mean I can't be part of the community. But it may mean learning how to deal with the fact that you're different and what you discuss with people and don't discuss with people. In this kind of a format, I will tell you that when I was observant for many, many years, I was a star disco dancer. And many people who knew me, I think Michael knew me back in those days, you know, would sometimes be aghast at the fact, I'm not saying Michael was aghast, but many people were aghast at the fact that here I was teaching Torah, and I had a whole 9 yards of a competition disco life that was set up for me. God put me in my place. I wasn't able to continue that after a certain point in time. But the idea that we had to spend time coming to a place of observance is something that many Balei Tshuva don't have today. When I told you this 20 minutes ago about my process taking almost 15 years, it's something that people today do in 15 months. And I think the idea that we have to work out a lot of these issues, for me, my struggles were around wearing blue jeans, around wearing pants, around dancing. And I'd say for the most part, you know, the whole relationship between women and men, tzniut, all of these issues, having grown up as a feminist in America, took me many, many years to work out. And I had, thank God, the time and the ability to be able to spend a lot of years trying to figure out where it all fit in for me. Today, many people are so intent on fitting in, they don't spend that time working it out. And I find when they don't spend the time, feeling integrated as people before they become integrated into the Frum community. There are many parts of themselves that just aren't worked out. And you can't be a totally productive Jew and a totally fulfilled Jew until you figure out who you really are and how God wants you to make your contributions to the world. And sometimes those contributions to the world have to be made in a way that many people don't approve of. Another area in this realm that Elliot and I spoke about this afternoon is my becoming a psychologist. I got zero support in the Orthodox world for becoming a psychologist 30 years ago. It was considered a totally trait profession. Well, I can't tell you how many of these people's kids have now been seeing me for the last 12 years. But I just want to end by saying that, you know, I've never fit in, and I don't think I've done too badly for myself. And I hope that one message that I can perhaps give to all of you is that there are many, many ways to become an observant Jew and a religious Jew, and that we each have to be very honest with ourselves about how within the confines of halacha we want to find our place within Orthodox Judaism.
You know, Lisa was talking about integration. I guess I wanted to ask you, Michael, if there are like signals or signs that indicate that a Baal Tshuva is integrating religion in a healthy way. And I guess, to be more specific, what's the difference between somebody who's got newly found but very commendable religious passion and fervor that becomes problematic or troublesome? And I was, how do you tell the difference, really?
Lisa's bringing me back to Memory Lane. We met actually a long time ago working together in a group called The Flame in New York. And I spent a lot of time back then. Oh, am I on?
Yeah.
Almost fell. Thank you, Molly. Is that better? I've spent a lot of time since then teaching people individually, and I don't really remember anyone in the past 30 years who I've thought was integrating Jewishly in an unhealthy way. I think that people's journeys are often rocky. I think people have their ups and downs, which I think often frightens Baalei Tshuva, that the relationship can become intensely high and then intensely low. I remember only one experience with someone whose passion for Judaism was, in my humble estimation, unhealthy. It was a woman that I was studying with who lived on 155th Street in Upper Manhattan, and I came to the apartment one night to study with her, and she was standing by the kitchen stove, and the fire was on, and her fingers were in the fire. And I screamed, I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I read in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch that you're supposed to burn your fingernails." And I gulped and I said, "That's after they're off your fingers." I think that often, if I have to find one area where people's religious exuberance, and I think this goes not just for Baalei Tshuva, I think this is a human issue. What I sometimes find disturbing is when people lose sight of the fact that the world we live in is not monolithic, that the Jewish world is not monolithic and should not be monolithic. When our ancestors traversed the Red Sea, we're told there were 12 lanes that opened up. And when we daven every day, we pray, we mention the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, because there isn't one solitary path, there isn't one solitary approach to being Jewish. And the disturbing encounters that I've had, Debbie notwithstanding, have been with people whose passion presents itself in a way where what I'm doing is the only legitimate way to God. What I'm doing is the only legitimate way Jewishly. And I remember that Rabbi Riskin used to always joke with us that someday in Jerusalem the archaeologists are going to uncover a shtiebel across the street from the Beis HaMikdash. I think that's part of our human nature, and I think it's healthy within the Jewish world to appreciate that there isn't just one single solitary approach. And if I had to identify one area, I think obviously this can be a much longer discussion, but one area where people's earnestness and enthusiasm for their approach, and it's understandable when a person comes to Torah from, as Eliot described, a world that is often so empty and decadent, it's very easy to get excited Jewishly. It's very easy to get overwhelmed with our Jewish journey. And I think that what becomes unhealthy is when we close down the broader vision of a beautiful, magnificent, rich Jewish world where there are multiple approaches, there are different ways in which we as Jews can come to God.
I wanted to posit something and see if you agree, because this is something I've thought about. Maybe I'll put this to you, Eric. It seems to me that the Baal Tshuva in some ways faces a kind of paradox with regards to his or her observance. See, on the one hand, because in many cases one has secular parents, so there's a freedom, because you can invent yourself, right? There's no sort of standard that you have to conform to within a family, and not having to conform to a parental standard of religion allows, often I've seen, a certain kind of creativity and depth that the Baal Tshuva can explore on his or her own. But conversely, there's a problem to this, because the Baal Tshuva faces, I think, perpetually a certain feeling of ungroundedness. Like you're always reinventing yourself, that somehow, unconsciously, there's never quite that kind of organic, rock-solid surface that many people I've encountered in the From Birth community feel, because it's sort of just like breathing to them, religion. They just don't think about it in quite the same self-conscious way. So there's a certain lack of model or authority that the Baal Tshuva has, and you have to sort of choose your model or authority from the outside, which is not always the easiest fit. So I'm wondering how you think this influences the Baal Tshuva's approach to religion, and in a way how one can negotiate that kind of dichotomy.
I think part of this takes us back to the question of integration. And it seems that you retain your independent spirit, which you never lost. But it's not hard for me to understand why people who go over to the other side, as it were, feel that they want to do so authentically. And they have no markers from their own background to speak of. So depending on which crowd they fall in with, those are the only markers they have. And it's I mentioned earlier my problems with the term Baal Tshuva. I think a sociologist looking at the phenomenon would really speak of this as a type of religious conversion, with all that that implies. It happens, I was on a doctoral committee just yesterday at the University of Toronto, where someone wrote a dissertation on Jews converting to Christianity between the 6th and 12th century. And every issue that cropped up in this dissertation is really applicable, you know, with some slight changes to the discussion today. You're really undergoing conversion, and it's characteristic of converts. This is true in the Middle Ages, and it can be true today, that A, they seek authenticity, and B, they sometimes want to be more authentic even than the native-born version. That's a legitimate, I think, even psychological reaction. And so it's, I think, often the case that some of the people who I know who move in kollel circles feel a certain freedom, or at least at that point felt a certain freedom to invent themselves, that I didn't feel, because I was, you know, only following the lead of the people who knew what meant to be Torah true. And since I didn't know, so I did as they did as best I was able. That being said, there were obviously transitional moments, but I didn't necessarily experience them as healthy. I often experienced them as troubling, and one can be quite guilt-ridden about them. I think of two obvious ones. I mean, one was, we're all into music apparently. I also was in a folk rock band. Maybe the common denominator, if you come from the... I remember Eliot thinking we weren't edgy enough at the time. And there was a point at which I felt an obligation to this band. You know, we'd been together, we practiced together, we'd made certain commitments to play in clubs, and at a certain point I wasn't necessarily doing that sort of thing. It was true also, I was actually playing in Godspell with at Forest Hill Collegiate as well. And but I was beginning to observe Shabbat, or more than beginning to observe Shabbat. And so for Godspell, you know, I ate Shabbat dinner, and then I went and I played. And then with this gig we had at whatever club, I don't remember where it was, near Bloor Street, I actually stayed at the house of one of the band members. I walked to the club Friday night. I played, and I walked home. But that wasn't something that made me feel like I was undergoing a healthy transition, I don't think. It made me feel like, you know, this is obviously nonsensical, since I just finished telling you that part of why I rejected, you know, so much of my Holy Blossom background is it seems so nonsensical because it's so often inconsistent. I felt, you know, troubled by that. At the same time, it wasn't quite the same time in my first year university in English class. I happened to sit next to a lovely young woman. His name was Mary, and we were quite friendly, to say the least. And her father was a senior figure in the United Church of Canada. He was, I think, number 3 in the church hierarchy, and this is the largest Protestant denomination in this country. And, you know, she knew what Havdalah was, you know, and when she could call and when she couldn't call. And I remember even, you know, there was one person who sort of knew about this, wasn't a Colwell person, someone who davened in the Colwell, and, you know, sort of chatting about this. That was a very tension-ridden type of experience. So, on the one hand, you're sort of free to invent yourself, but I think your feeling is, you know, at least my feeling was, everything is so idiosyncratic, I don't suppose I can speak for anyone more than myself, my feeling was that sort of consistency was the goal here, and Torah true meant Torah true in every respect, and the pressure was to move in that direction quickly, otherwise I was just being inconsistent in a different way than I was already being inconsistent before I found, you know, this new approach to Jewish living. And that being the case, but then I think there was a certain unhealthiness that creeped in. I often wasn't happy, and I think, you know, addressing yet the previous question that was asked, that's obviously a sign of trouble to some extent when you're not happy. Anecdotally, I also knew other people who had troubles. There was one fellow, Or Sameach in Yerushalayim, who became a Bratzlav Chassid, and one morning he described in ways that were just so overwhelming and utterly disturbing how he woke up completely paralyzed psychologically and was unable to practice anything, having gone over to a rather extreme form of Judaism. One last comment I would make, picking up on your observation, is that I am often struck by the fact that the native-born Orthodox community is very happy to sort of mooch off, if you want to put it that way, mooch off the achievements of people who do things that they otherwise condemn and would never have their sons and daughters do. And that was true with my drumming, but it's certainly true with physicians who I know, and so on and so forth. And there's a sort of odd symbiosis, but a problematic symbiosis in that way, where on the one hand these things are sort of ruled out of court for any, you know, right-thinking Baal Tshuva or certainly anyone who's born into the Orthodox community, and yet there's tremendous pleasure in the fact that my accountant is from and my, you know, physician is from, and when I need someone to play piano or drums at the local day school, we have people because, you know, some of them took 10 years of conservatory piano and so on and so forth. So that part, you know, gives one an avenue to express oneself in a way that allows you to contribute to the community, but there's a certain sort of oddity and inconsistency of the traditional community's attitudes towards the things that have to be done in order to get you to the point where you could contribute in that way.
So just picking up on that point, maybe anybody can take this. If you had a wish list about what the general Frum community could improve on in terms of how they deal with Baalei Tshuva, treat Baalei Tshuva, integrate Baalei Tshuva, what kinds of things would you be looking for? You want me to turn off the tape, is that the idea?
I've already gotten myself in so much trouble, it's not going to make any difference. You know, I have an immediate reaction to what you're saying, Elliot, and that is that we put a tremendous onus on the Orthodox community that very few people are subjected to. We expect them to reparent Baalei Tshuva. We expect them to be hospitable to Baalei Tshuva. We expect them to, I mean, really be there in so many ways for people that almost no community in the world is expected to be available. We expect them to understand things that they don't want to understand about Baalei Tshuva. We expect them to bring things into their community that they don't approve of in order to be welcoming to Baalei Tshuva. There are so many things that I think that we would love the Orthodox community to do, but I think it's also very unfair of us to expect that. It's wonderful when it's provided, and certainly it would help many, many people to do that, but I think it's unfair to expect it. I mean, I'll just tell you that in Jerusalem, I have people coming to my Shabbos table who have rings in so many orifices of their body, I didn't know that so many orifices existed. And occasionally they show up with purple hair and attire that, I would expect a circus clown to be wearing on a hot summer day. And my kids are very used to this, and they don't say a word. But you can't expect most families, expect a family in Borough Park to be welcoming to people like this. I don't think it's realistic, and I don't think it's fair to expect that. So I think that whatever I would say I wish would be there is also not fair to expect people to provide, except for very specific people who are not only very secure in who they are, but they're very secure in believing that providing certain things will not be at the expense of their families. For example, I know there are many, many families who are extremely hospitable to Balei Tshuva, and it means their kids sleep on the floor at least once a week, and their kids are told, we have guests coming, and you have to help the guests, and you have to do this, and at the Shabbos table, there's not time for their own kids because they're giving so much to the Balei Tshuva. You know, I think we have to be very careful about what we expect of people and not put people down because not everybody's able to provide that. I think it's wonderful when there are people in the community. There's a family in Jerusalem that every Shabbat has between 60 and 80 guests at their Shabbat table. I mean, most of us can't do that, and most of us shouldn't be expected to do that. My own experience is when I tried to have a huge number of people at my Shabbos table, it simply didn't work. I was exhausted. My kids weren't getting attention. And so I think that with whatever wish list we put out there, we also have to recognize that much of that is simply not realistic.
See, I agree and I don't agree with you, because I think that it really speaks to a much larger issue, which is how do Jews of all stripes relate to the world, relate to modernity, relate to the challenges of modernity. So on a practical level, I agree, and I certainly never looked for reparenting or being nurtured or et cetera, and I don't need everybody's Shabbat invitation. But on the other hand, you're talking about a dark side that strikes me as almost xenophobic, where the idea of me being at somebody's Shabbat table, and it certainly happened to friends of mine, was seen with extreme caution as if a leper was walking into the room, because somehow there'll be exposure of what this person brings in their life to that Shabbat table. So what this taught me on some level is that, yes, and it's complicated, I agree, because on the one hand, I do recognize that there's a difficulty in people who've grown up in a certain kind of world and want to propagate a certain kind of worldview, and there's also a certain amount of insularity. But on the other hand, from a global perspective, where are we going as a Jewish people if we create these kinds of divisions and these kinds of boundaries, where we say, I don't want to have that Balei Tshuva over because, you know, it's going to contaminate my family discussion, and they're going to learn about that outside world. Create that kind of environment on a perpetual basis and speak about the kind of ennobled ideas that we like to speak about, such as redemption, such as the coming of the Messiah, such as whatever these words symbolize about a people that is deeply fractured, deeply divided, where 90% of the people have very little, often very little relation to religion. I don't think you can afford anymore, unless you make a kind of tacit statement that we're circling the wagons, that I really don't care what goes on out there. It's nice if you've come from, but don't step into my Dalet Amot. And if you do that, you're making a very explicit pronouncement that I'm here to save myself, and you can go out and swim in the water yourself. Now, I quite agree with you that there's many people who don't feel that way, that there's enormous hospitality and chesed that are done by various members of the community. But on the other hand, I think there's a very deep ideological fracture, a difficulty with that perspective that I think is not going to go away. Also the phenomenon that many of us have experienced, where you're sort of, people take an interest in you when you're becoming from, and there's lots of invitations. And then as soon as you become from and develop your own, people somehow disappear, right? Now, I didn't personally experience that, but I've heard this many times, as if you're somehow kind of taken care of. And so, no, I really do think there needs to be a rethink. I wouldn't let people off the hook that easily myself.
Well, I can give you a wish list, having said what I said. The wish list includes being more sensitive to single people. Why aren't you married? And giving people lists before they finish the gefilte fish of all the reasons they're not married. A second thing that I think people can be more sensitive to is the fact that when people are discussing certain topics at their Shabbos table, some of those topics are coming from a place of deep questing, and they deserve an answer. And if the couples or families that are inviting or confronting this don't have answers, to say, you know something, that's a really great question, and I can't give you answers, but let me try to find somebody who can discuss this with you in more depth. I think that part of the fear that people have of being more hospitable is they're going to be confronted with themselves. And they haven't probed these issues for themselves, so how in the world can they begin to help other people who are grappling with these issues? I think that the Orthodox community can do more in most cities about knowing what resources are available for people and how they can direct people who need more than what someone can provide to find those resources, even if it's not their stripe of Judaism. I had the experience, for example, of speaking in a certain community, and at this point, having spoken many places around the world, I know which communities I can speak for in the same city and which ones I can't. And it's a very sad statement that, you know, if I'm in city A that has 100,000 Jews, I can speak for these four organizations and I can't speak for these six. So part of what I think needs to be done is for people to have an openness that if somebody, for example, I can tell is really questing for Hasidus, and I'm a misnagid, to tell them, these are the resources for Hasidim. If someone's, you know, in the other place that they really want to learn intellectually about Judaism, they have no place for Hasidus or no place for certain emotions or a focus on spirituality, this is a yeshiva that's really into intellectual learning. But people should be aware that it's a rainbow. It's, you know, not one size fits all Judaism. And when people come to your house for Shabbos, when you encounter people in shul, you encounter people in your workplace, you encounter people in university, we all can be emissaries for Judaism. And the interactions that we have with these people on all levels have to be things that we realize that we are going to influence and make or break other Jews by our interactions with him. If I could just add one last piece, one of the things that a couple came back to me and was very sad about and very affronted by was they had become religious in part through interactions with me in my Shabbat table. They went to a religious community that shall remain nameless, and they came back to me for Shabbat about 4 months later. And the wife practically accused me by saying, you never told us that Orthodox Jews aren't honest. We thought everybody was just like you. And part of what had happened was they weren't prepared for the fact that people are people. And they don't understand that, you know, people can keep Shabbat and not be honest in business. That people can keep kosher and not speak nicely to their children or to their spouses. That people can do X and not do Y. And I think that to the extent that we set bad models for people who are coming into perhaps more observant Judaism, we have to realize our own inconsistencies and try to address the fact that if we're going to be living in this world, the way to keep out dealing with our own inconsistencies is not by keeping out people that challenge us. It's by working on ourselves and seeing these other people as an avenue for our own growth.
I just wanted to say that I actually did not have this experience. I would say I'd probably engage in far more self-censorship around the Shabbat table. But I think that's appropriate to some extent. I mean, you know, to walk into someone's house and start quoting Spinoza, you know, when they live on Fairholm, and when their kids are sitting around the table, it's just bad manners from my point of view, even if it exercises me. I mean, there's an obligation to just use some, you know, common sense when it comes to these things. That being said, I can certainly say that it was the most insular part of the Toronto Jewish community that regularly had me at their table. And I can also say, maybe worth adding, though maybe not polite in the current venue, that often it was the case that I ended up in places that were not, quote-unquote, Haredi, and the invitations were not so forthcoming. And the truth is, you do need the Yom Tov meal, because if you don't get the Yom Tov invitation, you're going to be at home in your bedroom, you know, with matzah and ketem grape juice, which is sometimes what happens. So I would say it was very rare that I was, you know, made to feel, you know, in fact, I think a lot of the Kohel families felt that this was, you know, a good message to their children. People are actually interested in this. They don't have to be interested in this. There were rare occasions when people were crude. There was once fixed up with a girl of, I think, an important rub in Borough Park or some such place. And, of course, the question arose, why me? You know, given it. So the answer was she had severe diabetes. And, you know, I think there was quite clear that I had an ineradicable disease, which was my upbringing. And she had an ineradicable disease, so we seemed like a perfect couple early. So there were those sort of, you know, crude occasions, but they were really few and far between. I would say in terms of Whistler, and this is impressionistic, being male, I can't speak about female experience, but I think there was something about the structure of orthodoxy which militates against easier integration for females, and that is that the value for Jewish males is learning. And it means that at whatever stage you enter, but, you know, we're talking about ourselves, and often seems it was in your teenage years or early, you know, 20s and so on. At whatever stage you enter, you can have a point of contact with males who otherwise are utterly different from you. They can have long peyote and wear a bekesh or whatever the case is, but there's a point of contact during the course of the week and not just from Shabbat to Shabbat. And my experience was that it's highly problematic for women from Shabbat to Shabbat, because within the structure of orthodoxy, there's just really not a lot of occasion for women to be out there doing some formal activity. So even if you did have an invitation to visit someone's house, it would be, you know, to watch them, I don't know, cook or do the dishes or look after the children. And for the women who weren't at that stage in their life, it was a very distant model, let's put it that way. So I don't know if this can be improved upon, but I think there is that problematic structure just in the way orthodoxy tends to, depending on which branch you're in. Again, you see that I'm speaking from the Haredi world with which I was largely affiliated at the time, tends to divide gender roles such that it can be more difficult, I think, for young women interested in, especially if they're intellectually oriented, to pursue this path. And if there could be some remedy for that, if there is it with Nikarod and other organizations to some extent now, that I think would be an improvement.
Okay. I'm sure that a lot of you have some questions that you might want to pose. So what I'm going to do is throw out one more, and then we're going to open it up to the floor. And I think really for many of us who become from, the real reckoning is when you have your own children. I think having children as a Baal Teshuva really causes you to think so much about you know, what your own religious observance is, and will your kids follow in that path? You know, there's a wonderful Hasidic story about, you know, a Rebbe who is questioned by his Hasidim because he seems to be changing all the traditions of his father. So they say to him, like, how can you do that? And he said, I'm not doing that at all. I'm actually following in the path of my father. And they said, what are you talking about? He said, my father changed the path of his father, so I'm doing the same with my father. You know, so there is this sense of this constant flux. But I think that Baalei Teshuva don't have what the sociologist Alfred Schütz called the world taken for granted, right? The sense that there's this large world that you understand, that your parents are like that, your grandparents are like that, all your relatives are like that, and there's just a kind of easy, organic way that your children will enter the Orthodox world. In many cases, not all, but in many cases, your children enter a world where you are the only models in your family for them to think about frumkeit. And so their models are often adapted from the outside, teachers and so on. And I think it's really a very big challenge. How does one deal with children when you're a Baal Teshuva? And recent studies show that not insignificant percentage of children of such homes are converting back, as it were, are rejecting the orthodox path of their parents. So I'm wondering, I think that's probably a good significant question to end our formal discussion on, if anybody wants to comment on that.
One of the things that I've observed is most of the people I know who are Baal Teshuva want their kids to be more religious than they are now. And I think it's a good sign when your kids come home from school and tell you you're not frum enough. One of the things that I appreciate about my kids is when they come home and they challenge me about something I'm doing or not doing that they've learned differently about in their schools. And it gives me an opportunity to discuss that there are many different flavors within halacha. And their school has one way of doing things. And when they're in school, that's what they have to do. But in our family, we do something different. And that in other circles, they may do something differently, and they are all halachically valid. We have our posik, the school has their posik, our friends have their posik. And they need to recognize the importance of respecting the differences between what we do and what other people do. Now, if it comes to a place where I'm doing something that's embarrassing my kids, then we can talk about it, and it gets into a nice dialogue about, you know, what is this all about, and why are people doing it this way, why are we doing it differently. And I think it creates fertile ground for the kind of discussions that otherwise are not had by our children, certainly not in the kinds of schools that I send my kids to, because what they present is basically, this is what halacha is. And I think that one of the issues that all of us here on the panel are concerned about is that many people today don't learn that there are different halachic opinions that are all valid, and that whoever we choose as our posek is the opinion that we happen to follow. One of the things that I discuss with people at times is that as we become balei tshuva, one of the most important factors in who we become is making ourselves a rav, as it says, finding ourselves a rav. I know in my own case I've been through many, many rabbanim, and I think that that's a credit to my own inability to stay at one place and to stagnate at one place. But it's also a problem that as we become more sophisticated in our Judaism, we often find that we need to find a different rav who can accommodate the differences in who we become as we go along this different ladder of religiosity. And so for my kids, I hope that one of the things that I will give them is most importantly a joy about being Jewish. Secondly, the intellectual curiosity to plumb the depths of Judaism and not just accept everything that they see or hear at face value. Number three, the ability to live with questions, that not everything has to be resolved. It's okay to not ever find answers to certain issues. And number four, to be respectful of other Jews who do things differently than we do.